Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
You guys are going to have to forgive me for wearing running shoes. I use a treadmill desk, and I forgot to bring my nice like leather shoes, so here we are.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for being here. So let me start with just the radio opening. Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, see the club's videos on YouTube, and catch up with the club on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Nellie Bowles, tech and culture reporter for the New York Times, and your moderator for today's program. I'm now pleased to introduce today's distinguished guest, Tom Siebel, famed tech entrepreneur, chairman and CEO of C3 AI, and author of the new book, Digital Transformation, Survive and Thrive in an Era of Mass Extinction. Big data, artificial intelligence, cloud computing, and the Internet of Things. We've all heard of these innovations individually and their potential impacts. Tom Siebel is working on how these technologies can work in conjunction with each other to have an even greater impact. In his new book, Mr. Siebel explains how the power of these innovations can be harnessed to radically change and improve our world on a massive scale. He looks at how large enterprises such as Royal Dutch Shell, Enel, 3M, and even the U.S. Department of Defense are leveraging these technologies to predict functionality problems, decrease fuel usage, and find vulnerabilities in these systems. Mr. Siebel's current company, C3.AI, isn't it?
It is.
C3.AI, is described as a software platform for digital enterprise transformation. He previously served as the chairman and CEO of Siebel Systems, which merged with Oracle Corporation in 2006. Siebel Systems became a leader in application software with more than 8,000 employees in 32 countries, over 4,500 corporate customers, and an annual revenue in excess of $2 billion. We also want to thank our audience here and on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm Nellie Bowles, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in now, is adjourned. Oh, my God. I read through the whole script. We're done, guys. This was a great night. Okay. It's not adjourned. Everyone stay seated. Why are we here tonight? I wanted to start. You have had a long career in Silicon Valley. You could right now be retired on your ranch. But instead, you decided to write this book. Instead, you're here. What inspired you? What do you want to say right now?
Well, I'm involved in the creation of a new enterprise that's associated with a new step function information technology that I think changes everything. And this step function involves as we power into the 21st century, I think, we have four information technology vectors that change everything: elastic cloud computing, big data, the Internet of Things, and AI. Mm. And at the confluence of these vectors, we have this phenomenon called digital transformation. And if we look at the information technology world, it's gone from roughly a $50 billion industry in 1980 to a $3.5 trillion industry today to maybe an $8 trillion industry in 5 years. And so this is rapidly accelerating. So I've this is my fourth decade in the information technology business. First, the early days of Oracle, and then Pat House and I founded a company called Siebel Systems. I've been very fortunate in my career to be in the right place at the right time on a few occasions. And so this is about assembling a team of very talented, highly energetic, well-educated people to introduce a new generation of software technology that promises to change everything and promises to make the world a better place. And so this is my idea of a good time. And so this is why we're doing C3. If I could play golf, maybe I'd be playing golf, but I can't do that.
What inspired the book specifically?
Well, we began this effort in 2009. And the idea was, the big idea was to build a technology stack, a software stack, that would enable corporations, even the world's largest corporations, to take advantage of these technologies to design, develop, provision, and operate industrial and commercial and government scale AI applications. And in the course of visiting customers around the world, CEOs and boards in Shanghai, Rome, Paris, London, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, beginning in 2009, 10, 11, I frequently heard CEOs and chairpersons of companies talking about this need for digital transformation. And you know, after four decades in the information technology business, I thought I had heard it all. But, you know, I'm thinking digital transformation as opposed to what? As opposed to analog transformation?
I mean, yeah, doesn't what does this digital mean?
And so as I poked at it and, you know, and tried to find out what people were talking about, it became apparent that there was really no common view. But it was something that was very important.
It's kind of a visceral thing.
It was very important to them. And there was an urgency. It was something that had to be done, but they didn't quite know what it was. And so after talking to companies for 8 years, whether it was State Grid, South China Grid, Royal Dutch Shell, 3M, United States Air Force, Army Futures Command, I spent 8 years thinking about it. And after 8 years, I think I had an idea what they're talking about. And so this book, Digital Transformation, is an attempt to come up with or develop a common understanding of the term, what it means, where it came from, and how to do it.
Yeah. So I want to talk today about AI. I want to ask you about your personal life. There's one particular story about an elephant attack that I want to know about. But I want to start really broad, which is just kind of the state of Silicon Valley right now, the state of the tech giants. We're constantly talking about this, all of us in San Francisco. This is on all of our minds. Has Silicon Valley gotten too powerful? Are these tech giants too powerful? And I know you have opinions on this and are involved in some of these conversations. You were recently featured in a New York Times op-ed by the Kevin McCarthy. Tell me, where do you stand on this debate? What do you make of the tech giants right now? Maybe Facebook in particular.
If we okay, there's a lot to tease apart there. Okay, first of all, there's the question about what is AI. I will answer the question. Okay, what is AI? And I think Julius Caesar used to talk about Gaul being divided into three parts. I think AI is divided into three parts. And so we have this thing called artificial general intelligence. This is AGI. This is the stuff of Google DeepMind. And this is the idea that we're going to develop computers that are indistinguishable from humans, or perhaps even substantially smarter than humans, this concept of the singularity. In my opinion, that's a pretty far-fetched idea. You know, this is the idea that your refrigerator is going to take over your house, okay? And you know, the malevolent robot, what have you, HAL out of 2001, you know the story. I think that, the most powerful system that we will see in a very short period of time, computer systems that can do any single task better than a human being. We'll develop a computer like chess.
That.
Okay, good. Go.
I mean, that's like
cook. Okay, but the idea that we have
directions
a computer
to anywhere.
Right. We have the idea that we can have a computer that will play Go, play chess, bake a cake, and give you directions anywhere. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah.
So I don't think we need to worry about that happening, candidly, in our lifetimes. The second class of AI is what we do, which is commercial, industrial, and government applications, which is about building prediction engines to change the way that people design products, manufacture products and services, deliver products and services, and manage their companies in a way to lower cost, increase efficiency, increase customer satisfaction, and lower environmental impact, and lessen the probability of cyber attack. We can talk about that more later. The third category of AI relates to what's going on in social media. Okay,
yeah.
Now we get to your question. Okay, where we are using AI either to manipulate, say, 2.2 billion people. I think in you know, very disturbing in nefarious ways. I think that the social media companies, you know, have figured out how to make it manipulate people at the level of the limbic brain. This is that part of the brain that releases dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter that's associated with kind of the pleasure center. It is the pleasure center of the brain. And so we have people addicted to these devices. We have people who are, you know, we have this incredible tribalism where people are, you know, when we search for news, as you know, on Google, or we search for news on Facebook, it doesn't give us the news. It knows what we like, so it gives us the news we like. And so if we are a white supremacist, it gives us the news that a white supremacist likes. If we're a Me Too, it gives us the Me Too movement. If we're a Black Lives Matter person, it gives us the news that we like. And so it results in, you know, this tribalism, and everybody lives in an echo chamber.
This is AI being already smarter than we are.
I don't think so. Okay. Yeah, I don't think so. It's just using data.
If it's controlling us, manipulating our emotions, I mean.
Yes, but I mean, people manipulate people pretty well, too. Okay. And, you know, some people are pretty good at that. But I think what's going on, I mean, we have people who are living in these filter bubbles, in these echo chambers, okay, that are never exposed to views other than that which they believe, okay, because their views are constantly being reinforced. They become radicalized in that perspective, whether it's being a Trump Republican or whether it's being, you know, or whether you're being a radical Islamist. And then these media are being weaponized by bad actors, okay, like Russians, for example, as they did in the last election cycle and will in the current election cycle. I think it explains a lot of what's going on college campuses today, where people are unwilling to consider opinions that other than those that which they have. I mean, I remember when I went to college, there was a nut on every rock, right? Talking about, you know, Hare Krishna or something, and it was all part of the experience.
You go to Berkeley.
Yeah. I mean, today they stone those people. Okay. I mean,
wow.
They do. They burn them. I mean, come on.
Well, they're not figured stones or fire, but yeah, tweets.
Tweets. I mean, look at the stuff in the news that you write about. It's pretty violent, right? They're beating people to death. Okay, not to death, but they are beating people. Okay, so the story in the New York Times, with the op-ed piece in the New York Times with Kevin McCarthy this morning, what he was referring to is I met him at a social gathering, and I was talking about a op-ed piece, a piece of fake news that I wanted to write. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the fake news story was that the Postmaster General is doing an announcement that going forward, the U.S. Postal Service is going to be free. And there's going to be no cost associated with shipping products or sending mail.
This was your fake news plan?
This is the fake news story that I wanted to write. And it was an announcement from the U.S. Postal Service. And it was going to enable us to provide much higher qualities of service to a much broader constituency, uh-huh, and to the underprivileged and to the underserved. Uh-huh. And we're going to do the service going forward at no cost. Now, an additional service that we're going to provide is that every letter that goes through the mail system, we're going to open it and read it. Okay. And so that way, when we know that your grandmother is coming to visit, I mean, we can contact her and we can offer her hotels. We can offer discount travel. Okay. We can offer, you know, car service to come back and forth to the hotel and the house. And then, of course, we're going to open the packages. Okay. So that if someone wants to deliver a shirt, we know that they're getting a shirt. And just think what we can do. We can, you know, We can offer a matching tie and cufflinks, and so customers will be much more happy, and the service will be for free. So that was the idea that Kevin picked up in his op-ed piece in the New York Times today.
You really should do that. I mean, you really should write that op-ed, like the hypothetical.
Well, I think that's a news story. It's fake news. I just don't know where to place it. Maybe The Onion or But
I mean, that's the deal we've all made. Like, that's the deal we've all made.
I don't think anybody knows it.
I made that deal when I use Google. When I use Gmail, I make that deal. I mean, do any of us know? Do any of us know what we've given over? No. And guys, be filling out questions and stuff, because I want to hear what you all want to know. Okay, so what's the solution? So where would you fall on the debate? And then we'll get back to AI. But where I just kind of want to know, because this is what I'm writing about all the time. I'm obsessed with it. But where would you fall in the debate of like regulation, break up big tech? What would be your action item for these?
Okay, as it relates to social media. Okay, yeah. I think we are in an area where the social media companies have become more powerful than the governments that regulate them.
Yeah.
And understand these people are, I mean, they're really friends of mine, these people who run these companies. That being said, these companies are more powerful than the governments that regulate them. These media are being weaponized by bad actors. Okay, and they're looking the other way. I think we are so far beyond do no evil. Okay, we're way in another category now. And we're looking the other way, why our media are being weaponized, why the Russians are manipulating people, causing foment, and foreign and bad actors potentially are making it impossible to conduct a democracy. I mean, this is really troubling stuff. So, I mean, you don't know me, you know, my political views are such, I have like no use for government at all. Okay. Like very little use, let's say. But in this particular case, I think if government doesn't do its job, if government doesn't step up and regulate, we're going to be sorry. Now, whether this is an antitrust issue or not, that's kind of beyond my pay grade. Okay. But I do think that unless this gets under control, we are going to be very sorry.
In all seriousness, I mean, you are close with the leaders of these companies. You know these people. You're in the same dinners. Like, do you bring this up? Is this something that they're debating?
You know, there's
in a
few.
Palo Alto,
I think this is like talking
somewhere
about religion at dinner. You know, I think it's probably it's probably best that in social settings that we not talk about this, because it's unlikely that we're going to reach a point of agreement.
Because you think it's ruining, potentially ruining democracy. And
so. No, I think so. Absolutely.
That
yes.
Would make it uncomfortable.
I mean, if this continues, it's the potential that we cannot conduct a democracy. This is important stuff.
You were a leader in the dot-com era. What could tech giants from today or learn from the dot-com era? We don't often look back here. We don't often kind of learn from historical periods. It feels like tech companies emerge out of the ether and then we forget that there was ever a time before. What lessons could they learn from the previous?
Well, panel? These are not the first tech giants to dominate markets. I mean, some will recall that, you know, Microsoft went through a very serious antitrust investigation when they were, in fact, engaging in, you know, unlawful, non-competitive practices, came very blatantly. Okay, candidly, I think Intel was doing the same thing. Mm. And so, I mean, this is not the first time that companies have behaved badly. And the government got involved and kind of toned it down a little bit. And I think this is a good time to do it again.
So the lesson is mostly for lawmakers. So back to AI and what's happening right now, because it's fascinating in that it's both very confusing, I think, because I can't ever really tell what's AI, what's just sort of like data set. Like, I can't tell what's deep learning. It gets very confusing very quickly. I sit next to the AI reporter and try to glean what I can from his interviews.
AI is not a new idea. Okay. This goes back, I think 50 years. Okay. And the, more than 50 years. Okay. But what's gone on is after kind of the original thought in this field, we had this huge AI winter. Then we have the advent of these enabling technologies like elastic cloud computing that come from companies like AWS and Microsoft with Azure. And effectively what we have is, you know, infinite computing and storage capacity available for free. Hey, that's a big deal. Computers didn't used to be available for free and you didn't used to have infinite capacity. The underlying theory, you know, behind handling big data, and then advances that have been made more recently in technologies that you refer to, like supervised learning, unsupervised learning, deep learning. Okay, so in essence, this is about using computers to build prediction engines. It's not that sophisticated, and now we can solve classes of problems given the underlying theory and infinite computing capacity and infinite storage capacity that were unsolvable. And so prediction engine, for example, can predict disease onset with very high levels of precision. It can predict device failure. It can predict heart failure. It can predict the onset of disease. So we can use these technologies complemented with this other phenomenon called the Internet of Things, okay, which is all about basically a lot of computers competing with each other, like, say, order of, you know, billions of these devices. And so we can use them in value chains like, let's look at the power grid. This is a classic case. The power grid is the largest, most complex machine ever built. And as of the beginning of this century, it pretty much was as drawn up by Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse 100 years ago. Now, this decade, that value chain is changing from the grid to the smart grid, where all of the devices in that infrastructure are being changed so that they're remotely machine addressable with these things called sensors, this IoT phenomenon. So we can aggregate those data and process these data on these large grid infrastructures to basically, without getting into how it's done, increase the efficiency, lower the cost, reduce the amount of fuel that it takes to power
the grid.
You know
what's going to happen when it's hot, when it's cold.
Increase the cybersecurity. Okay, prevent device failure, like we saw in New York last week. Okay, and reduce the greenhouse gas footprint by a factor of two. So the social and economic benefit is huge. And if we look at a grid operator like Enel in Rome, that's the largest utility in the free world, these people are looking for 6.7 billion euros in recurring annual economic, social, and economic benefit from this smart grid infrastructure. Or we look at Royal Dutch Shell, that's, of course, in the hydrocarbon business, the fifth largest company in the world, about a 300 billion euro business, where they're using AI to change everything about the way that they explore, produce, predict device failure. Take an offshore oil rig, for example. I mean, that's a pretty good device to predict failure in advance, because if things go bad, they go real bad real fast. CEO goes to prison. I mean, it's not good. Okay, and so digital oil fields, we use AI to manufacture products more efficiently at lower cost, to predict automobile failure, aircraft failure, before their aircraft fails. So it's all kind of, in the commercial and industrial era, it's mostly goodness and light.
Yeah, this is all very hunky-dory.
There are some strings attached.
Also, I mean, if you have massive data sets and are using it for predictions and are giving those predictions power, then you can do things like predictive policing. You can do things like, it can become dangerous. I mean, what we see in China with social scoring now, which, I don't know, do folks know about the China social scoring stuff? Is that mostly a yeses?
No.
No? You go for it.
Well, in China, everybody has a social score based upon your behavior, and based upon your compliance with proper behavior as dictated by the Communist Party. And everybody has a social score, and to the extent that you behave, things go well. And to the extent that you don't behave and you have a low social score, that means you can't get a loan, you can't buy a house, you can't take high-speed rail. And so everybody is scored basically every millisecond.
It's like an Uber rating, but for your whole life.
It's Black Mirror gone wild,
If you remember, but it's Black Mirror. Yeah, it's not. I mean, it's happening.
No, that's
how long till that's happening here?
Well, this would get to our social media phenomenon, and I don't know. It certainly doesn't happen here by government. Now the social media companies may enforce this themselves. I mean, if you don't have the right political attitude, they can put you in social media purgatory, and they do that. But I don't think the government does it.
So you think here it would be done, the social scoring would be done by companies. I mean, it's interesting if Google decided to do its own social scoring or Facebook decided to. That's how you envision it.
I don't find that far-fetched at all. I think they have the capability and I could,
play that out. How would that,
I think
would
they that? Did that. I mean, look at Facebook. When government officials spoke out against them and started asking questions about social media, what did they do? They scored them. They investigated them during an election cycle. They distributed fake news. About people like Mark Warner from Virginia. So I don't think it's far fetched.
When they say they didn't mean to distribute fake news, they've made all these new changes. You don't believe it, or what do you make of where it is now? Your face is, I feel bad for the radio listeners because like 80% of it is that.
They did it. They got caught red-handed, okay, and it's unconscionable. And I think there should be consequences. And I think there will be consequences because I think they kind of ticked off the wrong people. And one of them is this person, Mark Warner, from the senator from Virginia. And I think he's on a mission. And I think he is a bright and powerful guy.
It's, I mean, the flip side to that, after sort of talking about or referencing predictive policing and the ways that AI and the tools that people are building can be terrifying, there's also the reality of a kind of AI arms race that's happening right now against China. And so, I mean, what do you make of that? Is that like a crucial, do we have to win some AI war, or is this a sort of a media story that is fake news?
Well, Vladimir Putin said in 2017 that whoever wins the war on AI will dominate the world. I believe that's true, and I don't believe it will be Russia. I think that we are in absolute, full-on, non-kinetic warfare with China today. The first phase of this we read about in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal all the time, where they are bad actors, and particularly the Chinese and the Russians are penetrating the United States grid infrastructure with viruses and malware, enabling them to turn the grid off, penetrating the financial services infrastructure at JPMorgan Chase and other places with viruses and malware, enable them to basically disrupt the entire financial services infrastructure in the United States. The Chinese have gone in and, you know, penetrated the United States government and stole 21 million personnel records from the Office of Personnel Management, including everyone, the personnel records of everyone who has ever applied for or been considered for security clearance. So, I mean, if that's not war, what is it? Now, as it relates to the, you know, the war on AI, it's all, you can look it up on the Wikipedia, just look up the 13th five-year plan, and the Chinese make their intentions very clear. Today, they're spending $20 billion a year on AI research, going to $60 billion a year on AI research soon to basically dominate AI. Now, in the United States, so I think ultimately we have here is a test of two fundamentally, diametrically opposed political philosophies. In the case of China, we have a totalitarian state, a command and control economy that's mandated by the 12th, 13th, 14th,
and
five-year
economy
plan.
That's slowing.
Pardon me?
And an economy that's slowing.
It's slowing, but they still have command, okay? And so they're mandating AI research, and they're getting it, and these people are very bright, they're very well-trained, and they are at work. Now, in the United States, we have this kind of very messy, democratic, you know, free market economy where the research is being done in garages in Palo Alto and storefronts in the Bronx. Now, it'll be interesting to see which system wins, but I guarantee this is most certainly a war that we do not want to lose.
Our system's already won, though, right? I mean, our system's already better. Like, the technology's better here.
I think we did the research here. Okay. We've gone from the age of discovery. Okay. Which very much happened in the last 20 years. I think mostly in the United States and Canada. Okay. To the age of implementation. So the technology, the tools are there.
And
the
Chinese have discovered here, they might implement it.
They have absolutely the same tools that we have. Okay. They are bright. They are well educated. They work 28 hours a day and they are, to be feared. They're playing a long game. And, there's a book that you might take a look at called Shadow War. I highly recommend it, about kind of what's going on right now between China, the United States, and Russia in sea, in the air, in cyberspace, and in space.
Why do you take Russia out of this equation? Why are they not the ones you're...
Russia's an economy, you know, roughly the size of Italy, okay? And I just don't think they can play, okay? I mean, it is. I mean, that's roughly the size of the GDP in Russia. So while they have a... I mean, I think pure evil does exist. I think this is one of the places that pure evil does exist, but I just don't think they have the economic might to pull it off.
So what they've been doing more with disinformation is more just sort of social engineering rather than...
So, I mean, they're trying to disrupt the U.S. economy, the U.S. democracy, democratic systems. They're trying to get people to question the validity of the democratic systems, and they're doing a pretty darn good job. I mean, they have the whole Congress kind of tied up in knots questioning the validity of the democratic process, okay? And so I think they're succeeding at their mission.
Yeah. Peter Thiel today said that he thinks that I know, quoting Peter Thiel, that Chinese nationals have, or that Chinese spies have infiltrated Silicon Valley giants and are sending information back or trying to undermine. What do you make of that? I mean, is that something?
It's unquestionably true. Have they invaded Google? Yes. Have they invaded Facebook? Yes. Okay. Have they invaded C3? Possibly. Okay. C3.ai. And so, you know, how many of these people are Communist Party members? Who knows? Okay. And, you know, are they stealing technology? Absolutely. I mean, they're engaging in massive state-sanctioned intellectual property theft. I think it's probably true at Google, and it's most certainly true at Facebook.
You have a pretty high-level view of this. You talk to both folks in Silicon Valley and folks in the government. If this is a war, as you phrase it, if this is a war, who is better equipped to be fighting it? Does the government have the wherewithal, the engineer? I mean, can they fight this, or are we going to rely? Is this like sort of we have to rely on Google to, or Alphabet to be the battalion?
Well, if we have to rely on Google, we are in a world of hurt, okay? Because I'm not sure they're going to be on our side, okay? And how can a Silicon Valley company, okay, that is basically monetizing Department of Defense investments, okay? Yeah. I mean, last I checked, Google didn't invent the internet. I think, you know, DARPA did that, okay? And last I checked, you know, Google didn't invent the GPS network. I think this is a Department of Defense program. So we have people basically monetizing DOT investments, okay, to buy their houses and their houses in Atherton and their build estates in Palo Alto. Okay, who refused to provide technology to the United States government. Okay, and then in the same week, okay, they will form coalitions with the Chinese. Okay, of all things, to come up with standards for privacy of personally identifiable information on the internet. Is this a joke? Okay, these are the same people who are developing these social compliance scores that you referred to earlier. So here, I think we have a funny sense of history. These are people who put the 30 Years' War, the Peloponnesian Wars, and World War II in the same category of ancient history. Okay, I don't think World War II is ancient history. I think we're still, you know, living in the consequences of World War II. So this is a horribly disturbing, and the people involved in that should be appalled.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Learn about our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for any of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now back to our program.
So then what happens? As an American, though, I'm just curious. What?
Either the free market economy works or the command and control totalitarian state works, but whoever develops the best technology is going to win.
But D.C.'s grasp, I mean, whenever you see some of these hearings, which we always turn on in the office, whenever you see these hearings, D.C.'s grasp of Silicon Valley, of technology, is alarming sometimes.
Yeah, I think historically, it's a fact, okay, that, you know, for some reason, the United States, when push comes to shove, you know, has gotten it together and come out of nowhere. Look at World War II, for example, where, you know, we saved the world, and we did. And I think that it's likely when push comes to shove, we'll do it again.
This is the most... This is the most patriotic night that San Francisco has ever seen.
I know my social compliance score is going to go down a few clicks.
I'm reporting you right after immediately. Okay. So, well, I grok that. So where are we in the sort of AI? You talk about in the book, you talk about how technological evolution. Oh, shoot. I haven't been asking these. How technological evolution comes in bursts. That it's not like a smooth curve like evolution, that it comes in, or that it is more like evolution, which actually wasn't a smooth curve, which was a series of bursts. Where are we in the AI innovation burst right now? Is it like the technology's basically been discovered and now we're kind of like figuring out implementation and figuring out who's going to be the best at it? Or have we not even seen what this is capable of?
Well, I think that... I talk in the book about mass extinction events. So the formation of the planet, happened about 4.5 billion years ago. The first forms of life on the planet were about 3.5 billion years ago. And then we all know about Charles Darwin when he wrote On the Origin of Species, and he put forth this theory that the planet was speciated through natural selection, which he saw as a continuous function, much like many people think of Moore's Law. The problem was that Darwin couldn't explain the gaps in the fossil record. And so he said, well, that's just because we haven't found the fossils yet. And it wasn't until 1974 that an evolutionary biologist from Harvard by the name of Stephen Gould explained it through this concept that he calls punctuated equilibrium. And so he argues very convincingly in the last 400 million years alone, we've had 5 mass extinction events on the planet where as many as 86% of the species on Earth have been eliminated. And the most recent being this KT extinction that everybody here knows about that happened, I think, about 65 million years ago when this meteor hit in the Yucatan and we had massive climate change. And this is when the dinosaurs disappeared, and the dinosaurs had been highly successful species on the planet for order of 150 million years. And he goes on to say that so when we have these big voids in the ecosystem, there'd be a mass re-speciation event of new species that would fill these vacuums. And in the case of the KT extinction, those were mammals. So that worked out well for us because these... Okay, so it worked out pretty well. Now, and so what the idea of the book is that advances in information technology do not happen in a continuous fashion, and that we've had step functions of information technology that are highly disruptive. Certainly the cell phone would be one, the personal computer would be one, the internet would be one, where we had, and every time there was these changes, there were companies that went out of business and new companies that came into business. So now, if we look at what's going on in the global economy, we're going through, in the corporate world, we are going through a mass extinction event right now. In the last 18 years, 52% of the Fortune 500 companies have disappeared from the list. They're just gone. Okay, Westinghouse, Toys R Us, Sears Roebuck, gone. Kodak. I mean, and at the same time, you write about and others write about these new companies with new DNA that are in the news every day, that like Uber and Tesla and Airbnb and Amazon, that are all about the application of these new vectors of information technology, elastic cloud computing, big data, IoT, AI, focused at retailing or focused at hospitality or focused at transportation. And so Tesla, for example, is big data, AI, IoT on wheels. Now, so we have this mass extinction event, and we have people who are very worried. They don't want to become extinct. And so I think what's going on is people are trying to figure out how to adopt these technologies in digital transformation so that they don't become the next Kodak or the next Sears, so that they survive. And there are people who are very good at that.
We have a lot of really good questions. These are super high quality. So I want to start with, could C3.ai, which we just talked about earlier, have helped guarantee the power outage we saw in New York City Saturday night? would be prevented.
Absolutely. We do this for utilities all around the world. It's called AI-based predictive maintenance, where we use all the data coming from the enterprise informations, and we do this in Enel, for example.
So you think that was like, it was just a sort of data communication issue?
No, it could have been addressed, okay, had they deployed. And by the way, Con Ed is, as it relates to the use of information technology, is very advanced.
Yeah.
Okay, as far as global utilities go, particularly U.S. utilities, which are not very advanced. Okay, but absolutely, we could have used, in Enel, for example, we use AI-based predictive maintenance for 2 million kilometers of power distribution assets, transformers, substations, reclosers, capacitance banks, to predict in real time of hundreds of millions of devices what device is going to fail next, what's the probability of its failing, and why is it going to fail. So absolutely, we could have used information technology to prevent that outage. We could have used this same information technology to prevent the fires, okay, from the transmissions burning at, right here in River City, at PG&E.
Can you name some enterprise companies that represent successful digital transformations and describe the hurdles or internal cultural barriers they had to overcome and did?
Great question. Well, I would say Enel, again, is a great use case. United States Air Force for predictive maintenance for aircraft, Enel for smart grid analytics, Engie in Paris for smart grid analytics, Royal Dutch Shell using, what we call digital oil fields to use AI to improve the processes of upstream, downstream, and midstream activities to deliver petrochemicals cheaper, more safely, at lower environmental impact. And so at Enel, they're looking for 6.7 billion euros in recurring economic benefit. At the United States Air Force, the Secretary of Air Force, which Heather Wilson,
get into the weeds a little bit. Talk, the cultural... explain how a cultural shift happened inside a company, or I think this is probably someone who wants advice.
That's the hard part. Okay, I would say that's the hard part. Okay, I believe that we are trivializing the application of these systems. There were some very difficult problems that we had to solve, and they are now solved as it relates to aggregating large data sets, processing the data at millions of transactions per second, and applying AI to substantial economic benefit. Now, let's look at a company like Enel. Enel has 77,000 employees in 60 countries, okay? In 40 countries, okay? Almost all of which are socialist countries, okay? All have labor, very strong labor governments. All these people have labor contracts. They have workers, councils. Their contracts say, the contracts say exactly what they do, how long they work, what they do from 9 in the morning till 11 when they take a lunch break until 3, and then what they do from 3 to 5. Okay, got to be careful here. This is being recorded. And it's okay now. When we deploy AI into these systems, we change everything about people's jobs, what they do, how they maintain things, how they operate things. So this involves...
How did the union feel about that?
Yeah, this involves renegotiating labor contracts. Okay, and people don't like change, okay? And people are threatened by this technology because it does, some jobs are jeopardized and labor unions are not real big on that. Okay, so we have to renegotiate labor contracts. We have to retrain employees. I think Amazon is now the leader in that. We have to, we have to retrain people. We have to change compensation policies. We have to change management practices. So I'd say the change management is really the hard part. We're trivializing, I think, the technical burdens have been overcome. We've solved the problem.
So now it's a cultural...
It's change management, and it's really hard.
One thing you did at your company was you offered employees you offered to pay for their master's in computer science. Am I getting it right? And then you also gave them a bonus if they did it?
Yeah, we're very big at C3 on continuing education.
But okay. So would this would you think that private companies should basically pay for people to go and get degrees, or like the Swedes in Sweden? There's a whole government program, of course, in Sweden, there's a whole government program. But there's a whole government program to pay for people to be retrained.
For people at our company who want to improve their skills in computer science, AI, machine learning, cloud computing, we pay for that. If they want to go get an advanced degree, okay, in computer science or data science, we pay for that. Yeah. Okay, not only do we pay for that after they get their degree, we give them a $25,000 bonus, a 15% increase in compensation, and an additional equity grant. So we do everything we can to continue to encourage continuing education so people can advance their careers, become better at what they do, become more confident and self-reliant, and serve customers better. So I think that
companies can't afford that.
It's the best investment we've ever made, and I think companies going forward can't afford not to do it.
You've got a rally going here. What are your thoughts on facial recognition software? Good or evil?
It's scary. Facial recognition software is scary. It's very easily gamed. For example, this is something to be afraid, okay? And particularly as it relates to surveillance, okay, to government systems, to law enforcement. MITRE Corporation has published a paper where they have now developed a technology where they have a pin that you wear on your lapel. And if you wear this pin on the lapel, virtually every facial recognition technology on the planet will recognize you as the CEO of MITRE. Okay? Okay. And I understand, as it relates to autonomous driving, I understand now we have stickers that you can put on stop signs that make the stop sign invisible to the autonomous vehicle.
So this is terrifying.
Yes. So this is terrifying stuff. So this is something I think I would be very concerned about. And I
get freaked out when I go to someone's house and they have one of those Ring doorbells because it's a video camera pointed at your face, and the video is fed to all sorts of countries where they're analyzing it and using facial recognition technology. And I'm like, I just came for dinner.
Be afraid. Be afraid. And plus, they have their Amazon speaker that's listening to you.
Yeah, I feel like I'm like my grandma. I'm like holding up a hand.
And they have their Nest camera that's recording all the video, all the intellectual property of which belongs to Google. And so be afraid.
Well, I already am.
It's scary.
But, let's say all of us go to homes probably with Ring doorbells for dinner. What do we do? Should we wear a little sticker that's going to confuse it, or do we just resign ourselves to it, or do we make new friends? Or
I had lunch recently at MIT with 27 graduate students who are in basically the top five students in each of their class at MIT in information technologies. These were pretty bright people.
You just told them to stop.
And we were having lunch, and I know these people through a program that we're involved in together. And, at one point in time, we're having a conversation. I said, how many of you think your phone is listening to you? Okay. 3/4 of them raised their hand. It's scary out there.
This is not helping. It's Instagram definitely listens to me, though, for sure. Because I will be like talking about something. Like, I think I mentioned Gillibrand's name once, and now everything is.
And then you see the ad.
Okay. All Gillibrand.
We were having dinner. Stacy and I were having dinner with a couple in Menlo Park in Redwood City, actually about 3 months ago. And in the course of the conversation, I raised I started talking about some book that was published 30 years ago that I'm the only person in the world that ever read, okay? And and some obscure topic. And then we get home that night and our computers are next to each other on on a long table. And she turns on her computer, brings up the Google page, and there's an ad for that book. I mean, come on. I mean, how is this possible? Happened.
Show of hands, how many people think their phones are listening to them? Okay, we're at about half. We're talking about the negative effects of big data and AI. Could you please talk about the benefits and new cultures that might emerge from this technology? I love the idea of new cultures that might emerge from AI technology.
Well, we're seeing new cultures on the internet, okay, excuse me, in social media that I'm not sure are good. I mean, all this tribalism. And,
yeah.
Okay, and the consequences are, teen suicide, okay, massive, unprecedented levels of depression, people who make it through high school and college without ever having a date. So I think that, you know...
The incels?
Okay. I'm sorry?
The incels? Have you heard about this?
No, no.
Oh, I'll tell you later. It's too upsetting.
Okay. Okay.
It's
so
a family
event. We're seeing many negative consequences today. Now, some of the applications that I talked about are socially... I mean, let's talk about precision health. Precision health will be the largest commercial application of AI. And we, for example, can take the healthcare records of the population of the United States, roughly 330 million people, radiology, pharmacology, healthcare history, genome sequence, and aggregate those data into a unified federated image. And then we can apply AI machine learning to do things like disease prediction. For example, we can predict with very high levels of precision who will be diagnosed with name the disease in the next 5 years, say diabetes.
Yeah.
And what are the social benefits of that? Well, they're enormous. By knowing who's going to be diagnosed with diabetes in the next 5 years, we can do it. We can intervene, deal with these people clinically, and avoid the diagnosis.
Yeah.
So the social and economic benefits are obvious. We'll also have very soon, and we all know this, genome-specific medical protocols that are highly efficacious. We'll have, I don't think we'll be replacing physicians with AI engines like the IBM ads would lead us to believe, but I think unquestionably we'll have AI-assisted medicine for radiology and diagnosis and whatnot. So the net is, you know, we'll have lower-cost health care, people will live longer, people will live healthier. Now what's the downside? Okay, here we have either your insurance company or even worse, the United States government has all these data, okay? And they know, that perhaps one or both of us is going to be diagnosed with a
don't give me something bad.
With a terminal disease in the next 3 years. What are they going to do with those data? Okay, the idea that all these corporations are going to act responsibly is, see Facebook for details. It's not going to happen. Okay, now how are these data going to be used? Are they going to be used to set rates? Okay, who cares about pre-existing conditions when we know what you're going to come down with in 4 years? Okay, will it be used to withhold health care in situations where the government or the insurance company decides that it's not, doesn't make economic sense to treat the patient? It will. So these are, there are serious social implications of the use of these, of the use of AI that we need to anticipate. So,
I mean, this is why we have laws. Like, this is why we...
Yeah, but government tends to regulate too late. I mean, let's think about this. You can draw, with every major technological advance, there have been, I think, massive benefits and massive and many deleterious consequences. Let's take the steam engine and the Jacquard loom. Okay, out of that, we got the Industrial Revolution. A lot of people would argue that the Industrial Revolution was a good thing. I actually think it was. Okay, at the same time, you can draw a straight line between the steam engine and the Jacquard loom and, child labor, World War I, World War II, communism. Now, so we don't tend to deal with these things until the negative consequences until we're very reactive. I think this is an area where we need to start thinking about what the adverse consequences will be, and
before we have to
live there.
World wars and communism.
Before we have to live there.
Yeah, yeah, insurance companies already could. I mean, they we have laws protecting. Yeah, no, you're right. It won't keep up. So for the person who wanted the positive, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Here's someone who wanted us to talk about China more, if you want to answer it. Why have we or are we helping the Chinese so much?
Well, it might be a good question as it relates to education. Okay, we pay, it's your tax dollars that are, educating these people to go back and, engage in warfare. And, we won't let them stay here and work. So I'm not sure.
I think I'm going to know your answer for this, but what role do you think public education plays in guaranteeing a democracy can function in today's technology era and going forward?
Oh, I think
I think public education is hugely important. And this goes back to Thomas Jefferson. I think that, you know, a well-informed public is essential to the ability to conduct a democracy. And so I think public education is hugely important. We're not investing enough. I mean, we invest more, substantially more in California, for example, in running the prison system than we do in running the education system. This is crazy.
Are you running for office, or is this? I mean, listen, Tom Steyer just threw his hat in the ring, so... No?
Tom's a good guy. He's a friend of mine, you know.
He's probably here, actually. Gosh, I can't read this person's handwriting, but here, I can read this one. What are your views on the role of location technology in AI? Do you worry about that? I mean, we talked about facial recognition, but does location technology worry you in the same way?
I think your telephone is recording where you are every 8 minutes, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so
but should I be worried about that? Because I don't worry about that.
I don't want anybody to know where I was every 8 minutes for the last 5 years. I have a problem with that. Okay. And your phone is recording that. Okay. And there is a record of every place that you've been for the last 3 years. And I personally, I'd prefer that remain private.
Okay. So that answers your question. Okay. The last two questions I want to ask you, I want to ask you to tell me one story that I found on your Wikipedia that I just really wanted to ask you about. Which is, you survived an elephant attack, and actually, so tell me what happened. How did this?
Okay, so my wife and daughters wanted to go on safari, and so we went to safari to Tanzania. And after about 3 days in driving around Tanzania, which is, I don't know if you've been there, it's just a big desert with a couple of mud holes, and lots of wildebeest. Lots of wildebeest. My wife and daughters got bored and wanted to take a day off. And one of the features of this place that we're staying in the Serengeti is that they featured a walking safari. And so I asked our guide, Lee Fuller, Lee, is it okay if we go out a walking safari tomorrow? And he says, absolutely, meet me at 6:30 for breakfast. So I meet him at 6:30 for breakfast. And the way these tented camps are, there's kind of a big mud hole out there with some water in it. Water's a very scarce thing there where all the animals congregate.
The worst description I've ever heard of.
It's not a very pretty place. I mean, it's just a desert. So he explains to me, and Lee Fuller kind of has it all going on. You know, he's got the accent. He's about 6'3", maybe 220. He's got the hat. He's got the getup. He's got the whole deal going. And he explains to me, well, Mr. Siebel, I'm going to be carrying a double barrel 470 rifle. Well, that 470 rifle, double barrel, that 470 charge is about the size of a roll of dimes. Okay, it'll stop an elephant in its track at maybe 100 meters. And I was going to be carrying a Nikon camera, but he explains that if we get charged by an animal, it's very important that you don't run, because if you run, this is not going to end well for us. Okay. So we go out at daybreak. There's not a breath of wind. And we go out and kind of skirt around a herd of Cape buffalo, which are pretty bad actors if you've ever seen a herd of Cape buffalo. And then about 10 minutes later, we come upon a herd of elephants about 200 meters out there, about 15 of them, half adults and half juveniles. And there happened to be a stand of trees there, and there's not a breath of wind, and it's about daybreak, and they're kind of ripping branches off trees the way that we do. And we just stood there and watched them, and the wind must have, for about 7 minutes, and the wind must have shifted or something. So there's me, the guide, and then the elephants. And the guide was, I would say, 10 meters in front of me. And all of a sudden, this one matriarch elephant, 5 tons of elephant, okay, she leans back on her haunches. You know, her trunk goes in the ear, her ears go back, and you just hear this deafening bellow. And then you could kind of see her, like, kind of focus and acquire the target. And then she takes a beeline at us. So this is 5 tons moving at moving at 35 miles an hour. An elephant is, I think, the only animal, I believe, on Earth that has four knees. They're incredibly athletic, incredibly, and they're big and they're scary. So this elephant is now closing in on us, you know, 200 meters, goes pretty fast at 35 miles an hour. So we have 5 tons at 200 meters, 100 meters, 150 meters, 100 meters, guy doesn't shoot. 80 meters, 70 meters, 60 meters, guy
and
doesn't
you guys are
shoot.
Just sort of
meanwhile,
still.
I'm standing holding my ground, and the guy's up there with the elephant. Okay, and the 40 meters, 30 meters, 20 meters, I'm telling you, the guy doesn't shoot. Okay, the guy shoots at 10 meters and he misses. Okay, and at 10 meters, an elephant is the size of this wall. Now he misses, and then so the elephant comes and takes his. The guy's about 10 meters in front of me, and the elephant just picks up the guide and just hurls him. Okay, so he flies about, I don't know, 12 meters away, about over to that wall.
I'm so glad I asked this question.
I can hear the air concuss out of this guy's body, and then the elephant proceeds to run up me at a full tilt and stop, right here, 18 inches away. I will just never forget this moment as long as I live. I can see it. I can smell it. You know, the hair follicle, the eyeball, the trunk, the hoof, everything. And it was like, meanwhile, Tom's still holding his ground. And and it was like, okay, fine. What are we going to do now? And then the elephant proceeds to knock me to the ground, kind of roll me, punch me. You know, I take a tusk through my left leg. He steps on my right leg. My foot comes off. I mean, I was taking hits like you can't believe. And I mean, it hurt. And this is the truth. And you know, at one point, I mean, I just can't tolerate the pain anymore. And it's like I'm being just jostled and pushed and rolled and gored. And I said, you know, please, God, make this stop. Look up. Elephant's gone. Guide is over there playing dead, lying on top of a double barrel 470 rifle that's loaded. I mean, he could have gotten off 7 rounds in this period of time. Okay, and so he knew I was dead, okay, and he didn't want the same fate. So then I said, and I was hurt, and I said, Lee, this might be a real good time to reload that rifle, okay? So he comes over, cuts off the backpack, and I was pretty critically injured. And then he calls the lodge. They brought a bunch of trucks and circled me in trucks so that, you know, to try to create a perimeter that was safe. Stacy came out. They brought Stacy out from the lodge, and I was lying there with my foot detached and my leg flayed open for 3.5 hours. And I was thinking, you know, a conscious thought, I don't have much time, so I'll keep this very short. Okay, the conscious thought was, what a miracle shock is, because I wasn't gushing blood and I wasn't in very much pain. How can you not be in a lot of pain, and how can you not be gushing blood? And shock, as you know, cuts off the bloodstream to your extremities, and it emits analgesics, so you don't feel pain. So it really wasn't that bad. But I lay there for 3.5 hours bleeding, went from there to a pickup truck to a back of a Cessna, Cessna to Nairobi, had surgery at the Aga Khan Hospital in Nairobi. You want to be scared? Have surgery at the Aga Khan Hospital in Nairobi. Okay, and airlifted from there to San Jose, 20 hours, had 10 hours of morphine. So the last 10 hours were pretty long.
How long before you walked again after that?
Then in the next 4 years, I had 19 reconstructive surgeries and walked 4 years later. And so that was a character-building experience. And went through a number of surgeons who wanted to cut off my leg. And when they did that, I would say, okay, fine. I'll see you later. Bye. We have nothing more to talk about. And then a team of surgeons in San Francisco actually saved my leg and did some miraculous surgery. And I think the gentleman who headed that team is here. Greg Bunke, where are you? And Greg Bunke is here. And he is the guy who put together the team that, you know,
I don't see it.
Saved me. And anyhow, it's a nice thing to have behind you. So remember, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger.
The Wikipedia article really undersold that story. The very last question that I want to leave everyone on is, would you have any advice for an engineering recent college grad on how to be part of the next innovative transformation instead of chasing its tail?
Yeah, if I were graduating from the university today, I would do the same thing I did when I graduated the last time. I think there is an idea, particularly in these bubble economies, okay, that being a CEO is a genetic predisposition. It is not. Okay. Being a CEO is a tough job. And the issues of dealing with customers, dealing with people, dealing with financiers, you learn that through watching other people and you learn it through mistakes. So if I were graduating from college today, I would go to work with some pros. Okay. I would go to work for a company like, just whatever company you think of is the most professional company out there in the pharmaceutical business, okay, in the retailing business, or in the information technology business. And I would learn the skills of I would become a domain expert in the space, okay, and I would learn the language and the skills of sales, marketing, finance, okay, human capital management, and then I would start the company. And I think it's a lot easier that way.
After you've learned everything. Okay. So now, our thanks to Tom Siebel, Chairman and CEO of C3.ai and author of the new book, Digital Transformation, Survive and Thrive in an Era of Mass Extinction. We want to thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Nellie Bowles, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.